This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I'm here with what will be a familiar voice to a lot of our listeners, I should hope. Welcome back, Christina. Christina Smith of Jodcast fame? Is that the right word? I don't know.
Fame? I was a veteran. That's really all we can say.
How does it feel to be back in the recording studio?
It feels very good to be back in the recording studio. It's nice to see some familiar bits and pieces. And a little weird to be on the other side of the microphone, yeah. If that makes sense.
And so what have you been up to since the heights of Jodcast?
Oh, yeah. So I moved to Canada.
That's quite a big one, yeah.
Relatively short-term move, shall we say. I've been in Canada for 3 years, and I've moved on more or less from stellar astrophysics, which is what I was doing before, looking at kind of small dying stars. Now I work on Mars and Titan and Pluto.
That is quite the change.
Yep.
Yeah. Do you want to go into a bit more detail as to what you've been doing?
Yeah, so I've moved on to kind of atmospheric studies. On Mars, I'm now part of MSL, one of the MSL Mars Science Laboratory rover, which is kind of known as Curiosity colloquially. So I'm now one of the science operations team members.
So the big question is, does that mean that you get to drive the rover?
If by drive you mean plan. Yes, so I'm a science theme lead and keeper of the plan. So I'm one of the atmospheric group who kind of plans and advocates for observations, for atmospheric observations.
So what kind of stuff goes into planning such an observation, that kind of detail?
Yeah, so there's quite a lot that kind of goes on. There's a lot of discussions that you have to take into account. There's a lot of constraints on various observations. And, you know, you have to take into account priorities of what people want to look at or what the rover has enough power to do and where you are in the current year, for example. Because Mars has very, very different seasons and different things are of interest at different times of year for the atmospheres group. And, yeah, also location-wise, if we're an area that has some, like, really interesting bedrock visible, for example, then the geologists will want that of a higher priority than, say, for example, looking for an atmospheric feature at that particular point in time.
So what personally have you been looking at on Mars?
So I've been doing a lot of simulations. I've been doing a lot of radiative transfer modelling. So I'm looking at the scattering of light through the atmosphere by dust in the atmosphere. And so I've been doing that to look at the amount of energy that gets down to the surface as a function of position on the planet and time of year. And then I've been using that into other models for various other things. So one was looking at methane production from the surface to see whether it could be produced from what's known as an interplanetary dust particle. So it's a particle that would sediment down, and looking at whether or not that could create enough methane that we would see on Mars. I've used these models for application to various things and various phenomena on the surface. And something that I'm going to be applying to hopefully soon is looking at the amount of dust that we see in the lower regions of the atmosphere as a function of year. But that requires a bit more of a sophisticated model than I have at the moment, so I'm in the process of developing that.
In the seminar that you have just given, it was a great seminar, by the way, I really enjoyed it. You were talking about how Mars has got different seasons where it's more dusty or more cloudy. Could you give us a little bit of information about the seasons of Mars?
So the way that we kind of think about seasons on Mars is we define it by solar longitude. And we define that, we divide the year into 360 degrees, and we start at springtime in the northern hemisphere, and we go round, so zero is spring in the northern hemisphere, like the spring equinox. And then if you get to 90 and you're, you know, the height of summer in the northern hemisphere and round and so on. But Mars is quite elliptical in its orbit. When we think of any given time in like a 1 degree period or a 10 degree period, if you were to look at your summertime, the length of that in comparison to the length of the winter in the same hemisphere, they wouldn't necessarily be equal. Yeah, so we have these quite varied seasons because it has quite an elliptical orbit. And in one season, we find it's very, very dusty. And that's when Mars is closest to the sun. And when it's furthest from the sun, we get cloudy season, which is called the aphelion cloud belt season. Aphelion because it's furthest from the sun. And the cloud belt is around the central equatorial-ish latitudes. Those clouds are formed of water ice.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So it's not water vapour, it's water ice?
Ice particles, yeah. Kind of like cirrus clouds on Earth.
Ah, okay.
And it's interesting because you actually see clouds like that in other places as well. Like, they exist in kind of Jupiter's atmosphere, but made of ammonia rather than water ice. We see them on Mars, and high altitude clouds are seen in a lot of places. But on Mars, they're very, very thin. If you were standing on the surface of Mars looking upwards, most of the time you wouldn't be able to see them. You'd only be able to see a faint hint of them on the cloudiest of cloudy days.
Hmm. So do you do much comparison between Mars and Earth? You mentioned Jupiter as well. Are there any major similarities? Is there anything that Mars is particularly different from the other planets?
So Mars has a carbon dioxide dominated atmosphere, which is pretty different from any of the other ones. Interestingly, though, kind of Titan nitrogen dominated atmosphere, like us, but it's a very, very different setup. I mean, Mars has a very, very thin atmosphere, so we measure it in millibars. Earth has 1 bar, 1,000 millibars. And on Mars, it's, you know, 6 to 9.5 millibars. So it's very, very, very low in comparison. The pressure is, surface pressure is very, very low in comparison. It's also very small, relatively. Although not in comparison to kind of other bodies in the solar system, but relatively, it's about half the size of the Earth. So it's pretty small.
Going back to what you were saying about the pressure in Mars's atmosphere, you were saying in your seminar that it fluctuates quite wildly over the year. What's the cause of that?
That's because you kind of actually get carbon dioxide in the atmosphere freezing out onto the polar cap. So when it's winter in one hemisphere, that will draw down carbon dioxide. And one winter is longer than the other, as I was mentioning, from the different season lengths. So that means the one polar cap has time to grow longer and pull down carbon dioxide and freeze out. Yeah, so that's why the pressure does actually fluctuate a lot from, you know, around kind of 6 millibars to 9 millibars.
And there's more temperature variation on Mars as well, right, than you get on Earth?
Yes, there's quite a variation. At a given time of year, there's much more variation than you find on Earth. But my fun fact of the year is that over this winter, there was a day when it was colder in Toronto than it was at Gale Crater on Mars.
That's quite something. I'm not sure if that's telling me how warm Mars was or how cold Toronto is. I've never been to Toronto, so...
It was telling you how cold it was that day in Toronto.
And it's not just been Mars that you've been looking at. What else have you been up to?
I've also been doing some work on Pluto. We were looking at bladed terrain on Pluto, so...
What's bladed terrain?
Bladed terrain is... So there's a region on Pluto known as Tartarus Dorsa, which is to kind of orient you. If you look where the heart is, it's on the right-hand edge, lower-ish, on the right-hand side. And it's described as kind of snakeskin terrain because it looks kind of very snakeskinny. And what it actually is these huge... blades basically of ice that are 500 meters high and, you know, 3 to 5 kilometers separated. My fun fact is you could fit the CN Tower in it. And you can tell I've been living in Canada. Yeah, so there are these huge peaks and troughs, and we kind of looked at them to see whether or not they could be humongous versions of what we see on Earth, which are these ice blades known as penitentes. But on Earth, they're couple of meters high, you know, tens of centimeters in separation. So they would be really, really enormous. And we did simulations of the atmosphere, and then we did simulations of the actual process that creates these penitentes. We used a model that's used to model them on Earth and replicate them well on Earth. And yeah, we found that what was coming out of the models was giving us separations of 3 to 5 kilometers, and, you know, they were formed only in methane ice and not nitrogen ice, and the orientations we were seeing lined up. It was an interesting piece of work, and it was my first foray into Pluto.
Mm. So that was with New Horizons data,
was it? So that was using one image from New
Horizons. One image, wow, okay. Are you expecting to get any more New Horizons data and you'd be able to do any more work from that, or is that your lot for now?
So I'm actually not part of the New Horizons team at all. So this was just one of their images, which was publicly available, and so we saw it, we were interested by it, and so yeah.
Okay, so if any more data were to become available, could that spark your interest again in it?
Potentially, but I believe we've had all of the imagery that's coming back, because it's kind of way beyond Pluto now. It's mm-hmm. going out towards the Kuiper Belt.
And if you got the chance to send something else back to Pluto,
definitely always more spacecraft. Yeah, it'd be nice, because we don't just have that one image. It would be nice to see it different light, different times of year, closer in, you know, because it's, you know, it's our best guess at the moment, from my opinion. Other people have different ideas, so it'd be very interesting to get more data.
If you could send a spacecraft anywhere in the solar system or beyond, would it be to Mars? Would it be to Pluto? Would it be to anywhere else?
Oh, that's difficult.
Can only send one.
So Mars has a few in the pipeline already, so I feel we've got Mars pretty covered. But, you know, beyond that, definitely. But if I had the chance to send one, Titan would be really cool. I'd like to go back and see from the surface of Titan if you could have something that could survive the conditions. I mean, the icy moons are interesting, but I would be worried about planetary protection. But, you know, there is a mission in the pipeline for Europa, I believe, or at least in the planning phase. So, and then there's, you know, Venus is really interesting as well. So it would be very, very difficult to choose one. So yeah, if it could do, you know, flybys of multiple planets, let's go with that.
I think a question that I have is, so you've talked about all your work that you've done on atmospheres and rocks. How did you get into that from what you were doing for your PhD? Because that was in something quite different.
Yeah, so I was doing evolved stars, so looking at small dying stars. But the techniques that I was using and the techniques that are available to analyse things like that are very, very similar across multiple objects. You know, you have to kind of get up to speed with some parts and some areas of science, but the underlying methods that you use to analyse an image from the surface of a planet or simulate the atmosphere is very similar to the method that you use to simulate the atmospheres of a star, but you have to very different conditions, and there's a ground. Important thing, there's a ground. But yeah, there's a lot of transferable techniques and transferable methods and skills.
And another question, have you been doing anything at all that could compare to the Jodcast?
I was on a podcast for a while. I was okay. So York has a live podcast that goes out on Astronomy FM. It's York Universe, and so I've been on there a few times. Going live was a scary, scary thing.
I know from doing Jodcast myself, the comfort of having an editor listening in, and yeah. But no, live does sound pretty scary.
Yeah, there was one time, because it has been a while now since I've been on, but I was in my apartment and there was some building work going on outside, so I had to mute my microphone and apologise over chat to everybody else who was on the show and say, sorry, you're going to have to take it over because there's drilling outside my window.
I mean, we've been having some building work going on around where we record the Jodcast, but I don't think we've had anything too bad so far, although you might disagree if you've been listening and can hear random bangs in the background. So what work is coming up in the future for you? What are you looking forward to doing?
Oh, so there's a couple of things. I'm in my last year out in Toronto, so I'm kind of looking forward to doing some applying my model to MSL data, so looking at kind of using the widest number of images I can to look at how much dust there is in Gale Crater, because you can do it without using a model and making a number of assumptions if you're looking at true north at noon and you can see the floor, the crater rim and the sky. We've been using that, but there are a lot more images that are taken, so there are a number of cameras on MSL, on Curiosity, and some of them are used for navigation, and some of them, which they're also calibrated, so we can use them for science, but there is another imager called MassCam that we also use. But for this kind of dust loading, we use the navigational camera, and when the rover traverses, or when there are other things of interest that it's imaging, it takes images at various regions and various times of day, so I'm interested to use as many of those as possible to kind of look at the dust within Gale Crater. Basically, if I can see the crater rim and a bit of the floor and a bit of the sky using a model, using my atmospheric model, I'll be able to process those. So that's kind of the primary thing that I'm going to be looking at. And if I get a chance, I'd also like to dabble a bit with Jupiter. There's some pretty awesome images coming in at the moment, so it'd be really interesting to try and apply the methods that the group that I'm working in at the moment is using for Mars and apply that to Jupiter's atmosphere.
Is that from the Juno spacecraft?
Yes. Yeah.
That seems to me like that's a completely different situation, though, because, I mean, you've got Mars's, you know, reasonably thin atmosphere, and then you go to Jupiter, which is, I mean, it's just all atmosphere, really. I mean, I'm no planetary scientist, so I probably have said something controversial there. But is it really something that you can apply to such a different situation?
So certain types of clouds have similarities across multiple planetary bodies. the high cirrus clouds that we see on Earth, kind of the very high, thin clouds, they're very much like the ones that we see from the surface of Mars. They're also kind of similar ice crystals. And on Jupiter, the highest clouds are ammonia ice. So different, but, you know, there are similarities and parallels you can draw. So it'd be interesting to look at properties of those.
Interesting. Now, I'm quite conscious that you have a train that you need to go catch.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Yes, but thank you very much for joining me and coming back to the Jodcast and for being proof that there is life after your PhD.
Yes, there
and
is.
And life after the Jodcast. So, yeah, thanks for coming back. It's been great to have you.
Well, thank you for having me.